एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
Hi, I'm Rahul Pagadi Paddy. I'm the co-CEO of ZedPay, which is one of India's biggest Bitcoin exchange. We help Indians all over the world, not just in India, help them buy Bitcoin.
Crypto, Ethereum, NFT, blockchain. Do all these words sound like Greek to you? Well, they sounded the same to us also till we heard this fascinating conversation in which Akshay Dutt sits down with Rahul Pagadipati, who is the crypto investor and also the co-CEO of ZedPay, which is among the top three crypto exchanges in India. Rahul brings to the conversation a unique mix of perspectives. He's a second-generation Indian-American who started up a venture in India. He's a very early believer and investor in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, and being a part of that ecosystem in the US, he's at the forefront of cutting-edge financial innovations that would disrupt how humans transact and invest for decades to come. Here's Rahul talking about how he discovered India and his journey.
So, Rahul, what's the connection to India? I mean, you don't sound like you've grown up in India. Did your parents migrate to the US or?
Yeah, sure. So I live in Durham, North Carolina. So, and I'm here. My wife, she's a cardiology professor at Duke University. And you're right. Like I actually grew up, born and raised in the US. My parents immigrated to America. Even before I was born. And really kind of fell in love with India, being Indian American, since as a kid. But then I moved back to India when I was 21, and kind of fell in love with entrepreneurship. Realized there's so much potential there, and moved there to start up a company. And I lived there in my early 20s up until I was about 25 or so, and built up a company which is still around. That company called Anine Healthcare Services. Employs 400 people, and because of that early formation of kind of of living in India in my 20s, had always loved it, and had been fascinated with the culture and growth and all the.
So what made you want to come to India? Like you did your undergrad in the US, and then.
So
this was like a gap year thing? Like you thought you'll see the world before?
So, okay. I went to University of Florida, did my undergrad in the US. This is during the dot-com bubble or boom, in the
right,
late 90s.
Right, pre-2K. Yeah. Right.
And realized that India, there's so much phenomenal engineering talent coming out of India. Like, why don't we just go to the source? And so, went searching for all this stuff, all these phenomenal people are coming in, and then fell in love with it. But I am now based in the US. Other than those 3-4 years where I lived there, spent most of my time in America. But I go back and forth quite a bit. Obviously COVID has changed that some, but like I would always go to India a couple times a year, and looking for a really cool, entrepreneurial and ventures and investing. And I would say I consider myself both a entrepreneur and an investor, and probably maybe I'm slightly more of an investor than an entrepreneur. And even though I'm both, they're related, because what investors are looking for is finding great entrepreneurs, and what entrepreneurs are looking for is finding great investors to back them. And the cool thing, because I've done both, you have a good 360 degree angle of how things work.
So, Rahul, I want to know about your entrepreneurial journey from scratch. Tell me about how you ended up starting a company in India.
Sure.
Way back in 1999.
Yeah. So this is when I was, a teenager almost. I was 19, 20, 21 years old, and had always been in love with building businesses. And I would read books about entrepreneurship. My older brother, he's a couple years older than him. He also loved it too, and so. We were reading, books about, you know, and magazine articles about all these really cool people doing technology stuff, right? And at this point, this stuff like Michael Dell, you know, had started Dell Computers. He started in college, and I was in college. I'm like, wow, hey, if he could do it, then I could do it too. So after this is the very early days of the internet, and it was very clear to me the internet was going to be a massive, you know, game changer in the world. And so I thought, you know, how can we do this? How can I make a big impact on this? And then where can I get the most bang for the buck? And it was pretty clear to me that there's a lot of cool innovation happening in America. And back then, these are things like Yahoo and eBay and Amazon.com were out. And really kind of saw that India was going to be like the next big space for this. So there is the company's now been sold. It's a company called India World. My brother had met the founder. His name is Rajesh Jain. We almost invested in that company. It was pretty interesting. If we'd done it, would have been a phenomenal return. We would have gotten like you know, 20 times our money in like 6 months. Hmm. Right? Just because this is the .com bubble.
But and, how did you have money to invest? Like from
yeah,
your
sure.
Parents,
so this is you know yeah, it's not, it wasn't a ton of money. It was me, my brother, my sister, and my parents. And I mean, I would say it wasn't zero, but it was like, you know, $100,000, $200,000. This was like,
which in
savings.
Rupees is quite a bit.
Yeah, it's in rupees. Yeah, exactly. But back then, you know, my parents are both physicians. They'd been running a small business. Was it vastly successful? No, but was it also tiny? No, it was like a couple employees, and it was making enough money where the first step really is, can you start a sustainable business? But that's anything. That could be like a, you know, a food truck. It could be like a small, you know, it could be, you know, even a cab, right? You're making enough money that you're not basically, you know, on the street. And so, and what the really step from going from there to the next step is basically just lowering your expenses so that you have savings, right? In the sense, if you live beneath your means, right, you can then get capital to invest back into new ideas. And that's what we did. Like, you know, it sounds crazy, but like, you know, you do everything as frugal as possible. And so we had some money. We thought, you know, where do we want to invest this? India seemed like a really cool idea. The deal didn't work out with the founder of India World. And I was like, well, you know, if we don't do that, why don't we just start our own business? Instead of owning a small fraction, you know, a minority interest of India World, we can own 100% of you know, a business we start up. So told my parents, listen, you know, we were going to put $200,000 into this business. Let's not do that. Give me $200,000. I was 21 years old then. And then I'm going to go to India and I'm going to start a company, right? And the family can own this. And that's what I did. So just, you know, didn't use all $200,000 at once, you know, spent like, you know, $5,000 and then $10,000 and $20,000. Went to India and then hired a team and built stuff, right? And kind of learned from mistakes, you know, a ton of mistakes, built the company up to, you know, 120 employees. And then, you know, we're making money. Then the .com, you know, crash happened. We lost money. It went back down to 3 employees, right? And then.
Within a year, you hit 120 employees.
Within about 18 months.
Was?
Yeah, within about 18 months.
Wow. Yeah. What did you start? Like, what was the business?
Yeah, so it was a bunch of different stuff. We were just throwing, you know, services stuff, building products. You know, this is like, you know, lots of different things, and
so like a mini Infosys.
Yeah, we were trying to do a mini Indian version, like Indian Yahoo, right? And some of the things were working, some of the things weren't. And then what wasn't
then
working?
You were in services or products also?
Both, right? You know, building, you know, an e-commerce electronic bookstore, right? Things like that. Like I said, like what. During the bus, realizing that, hey, listen, you know, we can't spend more money than we're making, right? Because a lot of the things like this, you should spend more. You should figure out how to borrow or you know, just lean forward. That's why we had a downside. We had, you know, when we dialed it back, we're like, hey, listen, only spend what we can. And that's why we went down to 3-4 employees, focused on services, which was money making, right? And then we kind of moved into healthcare services. And so healthcare, the reason why I picked that is both my parents are doctors. We kind of knew the healthcare space decently well. And that's actually what worked. So what ended up happening was in my, at this point during the low point, I was like, well, what do I do now? It was a good time to go back and finish up college. Also went and got my MBA, my law degree. But I was still still the CEO of this company. And, you know, we had 3, 10, 15 employees around then. We would be doing medical billing services or medical billing software or helping people, you know, figure out how to do like, you know, coding online and things like that. So during this time, this is on the entrepreneurial venture of what became big. The really big company is called Freedom Health. And my father, my brother, I, and my sister, we kind of all worked together and said, hey, listen, you know, insurance is really the best place to be. And so my dad, he's a risk taker, decided to basically take, you know, all of his net worth. We took all of our individual net worths, we put it all together, and we started a company called Freedom Health. And this is the thing about having, you know, you're talking about a background and a story, is that, you know, we, at this point, we'd had multiple failures. So you say Anion wasn't a failure, but it definitely wasn't a win. It was like a zombie type company at that point. And you have to go through lots of ups and downs. But my dad had like started like, you know, 25, 30 companies of them, you know, and 90% of them had failed. Like failed or not done great. And this was like, you know, this was the 31st company. And so
these were all like side hustles or like?
I would say yes and no. The first business that I'd say was doing better than, you know, than losing money was a clinical lab. And this is my mom, she's a pathologist. She ran a clinical lab. It was a small business. This is a business that maybe did like, you know, like $2 million in revenue, and it probably made, you know, let's say $300,000 a year in profit, $400,000 a year in profit. Right. So, you know, not amazing, but not tiny. It's enough to live a pretty good life in America.
Comfortable,
right?
Yeah.
And so,
yep.
From this that small lab, which is making a little bit of money, right? My dad said, "You know what? I'm going to take my entire retirement savings and the cash flow from the clinical lab, and let's go start a health insurance company, right?" And he had all of us kids, you know, kind of put in time. My brother moved back from New York from investment banking, and we started an insurance company. We just basically took our entire net worth and said, you know what, let's see if we can, and it was about a couple million bucks, $2 million, $3 million altogether, but $2 million initially. And we started this company called Freedom Health. And what Anion became like one of, you know, in a sense, because we knew how to run
a back office for Freedom Health.
Yep. Mm-hmm. It became kind of the back office for this company, but Freedom Health is really the one that took off. And this company became honestly massive. It, you know, we went from zero to $100 million in revenue in about 3 years, right?
Wow.
And
without any external funding.
Yeah, through like lots of just stretching and maximizing. And we brought in a couple of smaller shareholders. We eventually cashed them out. And at this point, we had basically, you know, spent literally every single dollar we had at the clinical lab, every single dollar. We sold all of our real estate. Like, you know, we had a couple, my parents had a second home. They sold that and put everything we got into this. At this point, probably about $10 million of capital had gone into the business. And
this is what, like reselling insurance or like an actual full
it's a full, it's a full-on insurance company, yeah. Okay. Full-on health insurance company, wow. Managed care company. And so...
Hmm. With like underwriters and yep. like the whole mm-hmm. whole deal. Wow.
Yep. And
wow.
So okay. It was complicated stuff. We grew it. You basically had to give amazing benefits. So we weren't profitable. We were losing money, but we were growing. And it's called Freedom Health. We grew up at this point. You know, we realized that, hey, listen, you know, we're out of ammo. And we decided we should probably, you know, find someone who can then become the majority owner. A guy named a really cool entrepreneur named Dr. Kiran Patel had kind of been around the block before. He had sold his business for $200 million several years ago. He had a non-compete that expired. He came in and he bought the majority stake of Freedom. So we stayed on as minority partners, and he bought the majority stake. And we basically took our money off the table, but retained equity, a big minority equity to take the company. And at this point, it was roughly 2007, 2008, right before the financial crisis. Very lucky timing by doing it right before everything had tanked. And he came in, and he was this is, and at this point, I just finished my law degree and my MBA at Kellogg, at Northwestern Law School. So I went back to go to grad school, kind of was still running NI and still helping out with, high level on Freedom Health. And then we sold the majority stake of Freedom to Dr. K. He grew it along with our help from 100 million in revenue to almost 2 billion in revenue.
Wow. Right?
And, okay. And it became the largest private health insurance company in America at this point. And so over 10 years, it took about 10 years from 2008 to 2018. Lots of hard work. Same thing. Every incremental dollar of profit went back into growth. We raised a little bit of capital. Dr. K put in some money. We raised about another $25 million of total capital. But other than our capital and that $25 million of capital that we raised, there's no other money that went into the company. And this company, we eventually sold for $2 billion, almost $2 billion, wow. About $1.8 billion. And during this path, what I was doing is I really loved entrepreneurship, but also loved investing. And so what happened was that within the family, my parents, who are more physicians, kind of stepped back from day-to-day operations. My brother did move to more as an operator. Like we would invest in companies and businesses. And along that that path, I took more of the investment role where I would basically like a value investor, try to value businesses. If we had any excess cash that our business would throw off, reinvest back into it. If not, then we would then just kind of sit on cash or reinvest back into our core operations. And so if we find a great idea, we'd invest. And it was a lot of small public companies. Like, these are small companies that are worth less than $50 million. And okay. For 3, 4, 5 years, I really just spent.
And you would buy a minority share or yeah. Like a majority share?
Significant minority stakes, between.
Okay.
And these are public companies. So call it between 1% to max, 10-15%. But $1 million to $10 million of capital would go in. And like I said, I fell in love with investing. Would be reading annual reports and understanding about cash flow statements, balance sheets, things like that. And during this path of me, really honing my investing skills, stumbled upon to Bitcoin and blockchain. And Anion was still going on. We had the Anion team. I had one of the 3-4 people team learn about Bitcoin. What is mining? How does it all work? And they spent a ton of research on this stuff. And said, hey, they came back with this is really interesting, but we're not really sure what it is. And I said, okay, well, let's research more. And when we started researching more, I realized that this is something that could vastly change health insurance, which is what we were still doing then. And so,
okay, like blockchain as a technology,
blockchain and smart contracts could dramatically change the way health insurance could work. And so, slowly, step by step, convinced the family that we should make major investments in the space. By the time that we sold Freedom Health, we had made a decision to move. Other than healthcare, our other masthead of investing would be in blockchain, and so put basically a significant amount of capital into let's say crypto blockchain investments. Of that, very simple, it's Bitcoin and Ether. Those are very simple. Let's say public tokens, almost we believed in store of value and we believed in the idea that smart contracts and decentralized apps were going to be a massive thing. And we thought these two are the leaders. They've already got massive market share and they're going to continue to win market share. And then I knew about Zedpay.
What price did you buy in Bitcoin?
All over. So we're still buying today, but we first started buying. I first heard about Bitcoin back when it was about, $5 or $10, but we really didn't buy it until it was about $7,500.
Right? Amazing.
So yeah. And it really is funny because when I bought, let's say at $100, I was like, oh man, this thing used to be $5 or $10. But it was like at 10x back then, right? And so, we've been buying back then and holding on and still buying now. And so I knew about Zedpay and the Zedpay team and I met the founders and the management team at a Bitcoin conference in New York. And at this point, this is right when the RBI decision had happened on making Bitcoin per se very hard with banking, right? People were saying it's illegal. It wasn't made illegal. It was just they put up a lot of, let's say, hurdles in place for, yep. and convince the founders that, hey, listen, you know, we're entrepreneurs and investors. We'd like to buy a significant minority stake in the company. We decided to do it at that time. And then...
Tell me a bit about Zepay's history also. Like,
sure.
How did it start? And like,
so
I believe it's almost like a seven-year-old company now.
Yeah. So Zepay, really cool company founded by three phenomenal entrepreneurs. Mahin Gupta, who's really more the CTO role, Sarv Agarwal, who was the founding CEO, and Sunny Goenka, Sandeep, he was more like the CMO and COO. These three guys all have, you know, entrepreneurial backgrounds. Mahin had actually started the very first Bitcoin exchange in India. It's called buysellbitco.in. And, you know, we actually bought some Bitcoin from him back then too. So I knew about him, and I knew he was a very solid guy. Same thing, because of, you know, regulatory hassle and whatever, he kind of like shut down buysellbitco.in, and I would say that kind of morphed into Zepay, right? And Zepay ended up building a phenomenal product, ended up becoming basically the largest, you know, Bitcoin exchange in India during the 2015, 16, 17, you know, run up in Bitcoin prices. And had 65-70% market share. They're doing really, really well. And then all of a sudden, the door got slammed shut with the Reserve Bank of India, right? And then they try to go global. They try to build a global product, but it's hard. It was really hard competing against Binance and Coinbase. And the founders kind of decided, hey, listen, you know, if we can't really operate in India, it's not really worth, you know, doing this stuff. And so they kind of wanted to step down. I was like, well, listen, you guys can step down, but like, I don't want to quit. Like, I think it's really important that, you know, that Zepay stays alive. And
when did you invest in Zepay?
The first investment happened in 2018. And then in the end of 2019, basically in 2020, January 1st, 2020 was when I bought the majority stake of Zepay. All right. And same thing happened in this scenario is that I told the family, hey, listen, you know, this is not the time to quit. We should, you know, really be, you know, doubling down on Zepay. The family office, which is really, we now have a family office called Aon Capital, which is, it's all just family run capital. They didn't want to do the follow-on investment in Zepay, but I believed in it. So I kind of took my own capital and then bought the majority stake. And that was roughly about a year and a half ago, January.
So what made you switch from being an investor to an operator, you know, and putting in your personal money into it? Like, yeah. What made you want to do that?
It's simple. Let's say love of Bitcoin, right? And so I felt, this is before, I was negotiating this before YZRX had sold out to Binance. I had felt that, I'd seen what happened with Mt. Gox, and Mt. Gox was another Bitcoin exchange, which kind of had a ton of market share, and it really kind of hurt the Bitcoin industry when it went down. And I was like, you know what? If Zepay quits, this is bad for the industry, bad for Bitcoin, you know, bad for India. And decided, you know what? Sometimes you just have to, it's like in wartime, times of war, times of like, you know, uncertainty, a leader just has to step up, even though, you know, you realize that I'm not probably even the best person for this, but if no one else does this, then we all fall down. And so decided that this is something which I was passionate about. This is something that I wanted to, like, you know, run until the very end. And convinced my wife that this was, you know, a thing that we should do. And it was something that I loved doing. And she luckily believed in me too. And we did it. Decided to jump into the deep end of the pool.
So what was like the peak of the like the value of transactions through Zepay pre the RBI ban coming in or the RBI restrictions coming in?
Yeah, sure. We did about $3 billion in volume total. You know, the peak would have been maybe about, you know, $30-$50 million a day. Maybe 20, $30 million a day. And like I said, it was massive. Zepay was definitely one of the biggest exchanges in the world at that point, right?
Wow. Okay. And so, you know, during that, like the long winter of crypto, yeah. So what did it come down to? And, you know, like tell me about that journey.
Yeah, sure. So exactly. So the RBI decision happened in, let's say, spring of 2018. ZenPay made the strategic decision to kind of expand abroad, but it was very hard, right? Because we're competing against massive players.
You invested pre-RBI decision or post?
Post, like right after that, right? We invested roughly July of 2018.
Very, very contrarian call.
Exactly. I realized that, you know what, we believe in the company, believe in the team, believe in the brand, and you know, we wanted to come, you know, like I said, we want to invest into India and into blockchain. And so during the crypto winter, it was awful. Like, this is Bitcoin had taken from $20,000 down to $3,000, and Ether had gone from like $1,400 down to $100. And luckily, because I'd been through a couple cycles, I realized that this is you know, something that we believe in. So I convinced the family, hey, listen, I don't know when it's going to bottom, but we said, as long as we invest over the long run, we'll do fine. And so that's what we did. So we were heavy buyers of Bitcoin and ETH back when everything was falling down, right? And realized that, so now we're not just Bitcoin and Ether. We made investments in you know, ZenPay. The family office also made investments in a company called Brave Browser. It's a kind of a, I don't know if you've heard of Brave Browser.
Privacy focused. Yeah.
It's a price focused browser. We made investments in Coinbase, in a lot of really cool funds. These are like things like Pantera and DCG, crypto focused, you know, blockchain hedge funds, and invested heavily, like, you know, and really made, like I said, blockchain, you know, the other focus here for the family office other than healthcare. And then during this path, during this winter, you know, it was cold and dark and, you know, depressing, but you just had to, like, you know, put one foot ahead of it itself and then move forward. And I would say, because it was cold, dark, and depressing, that's why I think, you know, a lot of the old employees and the founders wanted to get out. So there's a lot of people left, a lot of the best people left. Right. But luckily, hey, listen, a lot of really, really good people, phenomenal people stayed on and they believed in the product, believed in the company. And I was really lucky that to meet these people, and then when I decided to become CEO, like I said, very lucky these people, you know, believed in the vision. They stuck on board, and, you know, we were 40 employees back when I became CEO, and now we're almost, you know, 200. We're 180 employees now, right? And so got lucky, focused hard on you know, fixing the product, making better and better. And the RBI decision was overturned by the Supreme Court, you know, 3 months, 4 months after I became CEO. And then it was full steam ahead. It was just rebuilding brick by brick. The big issue is that we'd lost our lead as being the number one player. Binance, which had acquired YZRX, which is a very well-funded company, gave them a lot of capital and also, you know, let's say technical infrastructure on how to scale. And a couple other companies that are out there are also doing well too. But like, really what we realized is that, you know what, We just have to stick to our core principle, what we want to do, and we'll do fine. And that really is, you know, providing phenomenal service, trying to, you know, up the game on the technology and the product, right? And doing it at a very, very low cost. And so that's what we're trying to build, basically the best way you can buy Bitcoin, you know, at the lowest possible price and the best possible service.
If you like to hear stories of founders, then we have tons of great stories from entrepreneurs who have built billion-dollar businesses. Just search for the Founder Thesis podcast on any audio streaming app like Spotify, Gaana, Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to the show.
So, what has the build-up journey been like? Like, you know, at the lowest, what kind of monthly transactions were happening, and what is it today?
Yeah.
Like, tell me about.
So the company is doing really well. It's phenomenally profitable, and we actually were planning on making some of these documents public. But, like, you know, didn't even raise that much capital, but doing, you know, north of $35 million in revenue, almost like, say, $25 million in EBITDA before I came on board, right? And this is a business which people were lining up to invest in. Like, we had a lot of really famous Silicon Valley venture capital firms wanting to invest in the company. But then, like I said, they backed off once the RBI decision happened. And then really, your question on the revenue number, exactly, is it basically went to zero. You know, during the time when we invested, like, you know, it went to nothing. And that's a big reason why, you know, we decided, do we want to stay afloat? And I mean, ZedPay, honestly, for other than like a week or two, I mean, there was a good chance that we just would have just shut down, right? And said, you know what, it's not working. We're going to return money to shareholders. And that was, in a sense, the plan. And what I realized is that, you know what, this is when I came on as CEOs. I was like, you know, all we have to do is we just have to make enough money to not, like, we just have to survive and not die.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
that was the goal. The goal for me coming back on board was thriving. It was not thriving. It was just surviving so that we could live to fight another day. And then, but since then, is it, you know, we've come back and you know, we've done over $1 billion of volume a month. You know, I don't know how much we're doing each day, but we do, say, between 10 and, like, you know, on really good days, $50 million of volume per day. You know, I think we're probably maybe the third biggest exchange now. We're number one. I think WiseUX is probably number one. Maybe, you know, I'm seeing Coin26 is at 20 million. We're at 11.2 million, right? So, WiseUX is about 60, right? So still doing a ton of volume, but like I said, you know, our goal right now is to, you know, build back more market share, drive the cost of buying crypto down to almost to zero.
How would you do that?
Yeah, so this is the innovation on the business model. And I've been really figuring out, like, you know, how can we build a long-term sustainable business? And the big asterisk here is what we've done now is we have a phenomenal leader named Avinash Shekhar, who's a CFO, then became the president, and now he's now the co-CEO. And so, you know, he's still fine-tuned, but the core point on how do we actually drive the cost down to zero, you kind of need not just capital, you need business model innovation. And my thesis on this is that if we can become like a company which is more mutual focused, right? A company which is in a sense owned by its members. And what I mean by this, you know what a cooperative is, is we want to become more of like a Bitcoin cooperative in the longer run. And what my intent is, because I'm the majority owner of ZedPay right now, is I want to figure out somehow creating a trust, which would then give economic benefit of our, let's say, you know, our company back to not just the shareholders, but back to our members. And by members, I mean our customers. And there's a lot of complexities here. We're trying to figure out exactly how to do it, but we basically want to somehow have economic, you know, beneficial economic ownership back on the blockchain. And the way you can drive, like, you know, how can you drive the costs of buying something down to zero? It's kind of like this. Imagine if, you know, you've heard, like, you know, like a cooperative bank. What a cooperative bank works is that, you know, the actual people who are doing the deposits are they're the owners, right? So their cost of funds is lower. So at the end of the year, if we can basically take half of the money that we're making and give rebates back to customers, right? I envision that we can be a way, way, way low cost provider. The other way you can do stuff is this, is that you can make the trading fee zero, and you can also move some of the income into DeFi. You help people get money through decentralized financial products. And DeFi is really cool because you have things called liquidity mining. People were probably wondering what that is. It's a way of adding capital onto the blockchain, and you're basically getting paid because your money is tied up into a smart contract versus being tied up in cold storage. I don't know. Are you familiar with the word cold storage and what it is?
No. There's a lot of stuff which you'll have to, like, break down and simplify.
Yeah, sure. So really, when you own something like Bitcoin, you kind of own it in like three different ways. You can own it, let's say, in cold storage, which is really you've figured a way to own the private keys. This is like your password to your Bitcoin in a secure manner, which has not really ever touched the internet. It's very hard for someone, a hacker, to get access to these because these keys are not directly connected to the internet. Like they're in some, it's a seed key connected offline in a sense.
Right.
The other way you can do it
is cold storage.
Yeah, it's called cold storage.
Okay.
The other thing you can do is you can keep your Bitcoin in a centralized provider, something like a ZedPay, or Coinbase or a BlockFi. And what we do is, we then keep a good bit in cold storage. We keep some in warm wallets, hot wallets. We also lend some out to other customers, right? And the benefit of this is that if you lose your password, you can come back to us. The also benefit is we pay interest to it. So we have a really great, you know, service called Earn and Lend, and you can make interest off of your crypto, right?
Okay.
And then the last thing you can do is, if you want to, you can keep probably your crypto on, you know, a decentralized type wallet. Something, imagine like a Brave browser, right? Brave, you can use a crypto wallet on Brave. You can use a crypto wallet like on MetaMask. You could use a third party wallet, a decentralized wallet. There's a bunch of these, right? And so these type of wallets are also a bit, but you shouldn't really put a ton of money here. You should probably use more. This is more like you know, this is the type of money you'd actually have in a real wallet, like, you know, a few hundred bucks at maximum, right? You shouldn't keep a ton of money in there. The most amount of money you should actually keep in more in a vault or in a storage, right? So what Zepay is, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I still didn't get what is a decentralized wallet?
Yeah, a decentralized wallet would be like, see, you can actually put a wallet into your browser, right? And what this means is, and this is what Brave is. Brave has a crypto wallet built into the browser. So when you're browsing, literally you're on, like, let's say a publisher, and there's a paywall there. You click a button. The Bitcoin doesn't really live in your wallet, but it's a simple password you put in, and it's kind of built into your browser, right? And this is like a decentralized wallet. It's connected to, in a sense, to Bitcoin, but it's not as secure as what a cold storage wallet would be, right?
Okay, yeah. Got it. Yeah. Okay. So these are the three ways in which you can own Bitcoin. And you also spoke about DeFi, decentralized finance. What exactly is that? Can you break that down also?
DeFi is fascinating to me. It stands for decentralized finance. And, you know, it's the opposite of centralized finance. And centralized finance is, I'd say, the current system we have right now. It's a current system which is widely used. It's, you know, there's central banks. They work with large, you know, let's say blue chip retail banks, you know, and in India, these are things like ICICI, HDFC, things like that. And they also have smaller regional banks as well. But like I said, the biggest banks have, you know, the best relationship with the central banks. And it works in a lot of different countries, right? And so what DeFi works is, you don't need decentralized finance. You don't need a counterparty to do actually financial activities. And so when you go to a bank right now, you go to a bank, you give them your rupees. You give them your dollars, and they will then take that. They use their own capital. They'll then meet someone who wants a house, and they will underwrite a loan and say, listen, you give me the title to your house, and I'll give you a 50% loan to value. Your house costs one crore. You have 50 lakhs down. I'll give you a loan for 50 lakhs. And if you don't pay me, I'm going to foreclose on your house. In the same way, the way DeFi works is, you have one Ether or one Bitcoin, right? And imagine it's one Bitcoin, and you can actually go into a smart contract, and you can lock up your Bitcoin into a smart contract. Say, my Bitcoin is now worth $40,000. This smart contract will then loan you 50% loan to value. It'll loan you $20,000. And but the price of Bitcoin can fluctuate, right? So if the price of Bitcoin goes up, great. It goes to $100,000, you're still well collateralized. But the price of Bitcoin drops down to $30,000, you either have to give in another $10,000 of Bitcoin, or what the smart contract will do is, it will just liquidate $5,000 of your Bitcoin, right? So now what happens, your loan to value is better, right? It auto executes. It's pretty cool. Like, you know, someone can come in and bid on your Bitcoin. And so and DeFi is pretty phenomenal, because now there's like, you know, $50 billion in DeFi. Or more than that. There's massive amounts of capital in DeFi. And most of it is happening on Ethereum. But there's other chains who are doing a lot of really cool stuff. And this is really where I say, I think the world's going. The world's moving into a DeFi world.
Okay. So how does this tie into your business model innovation at Zepay?
Sure. So that's exactly it. So what I envision happening is, DeFi is complex. It's kind of hard to understand. And, you know, people want a lot of handholding, right? And so what I think Zepay is doing is, our goal is, because we are in many ways a fiat on-ramp. We're helping people get into crypto using, you know, let's say traditional fiat rails. We want to make DeFi easy, right? And so we're working on a lot of different really cool things like that. Like, for example, you know, most people want DeFi type returns. DeFi can give you great returns, right? but they don't know how to use a smart contract. They don't know how to use a wallet. So we want to be able to come in and you just put your money in Zepay, and Zepay will do all the complex stuff for you, and you'll get a good return. We'll give you the interest rates you could be getting on DeFi. I envision something like that. Like, our goal is to make it really easy and simple for people.
Okay. And how far along are you in that product journey? Like,
We're doing well. So we have kind of two major products right now. One is called Zepay, which is our main flagship product. The other product is called Zeb.com.
Which is essentially a transaction platform. You can buy, sell, and store crypto on the Zepay platform.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the other product is called Zeb.com. It's really like a simple version, like a much easier version to buy this stuff. And we already have a new product right now where you can get interest. And that's what a large part of the interest right now is being put into DeFi, right? And eventually what happens is you'll be able to borrow and lend from Zepay, but even the funding's going to actually come from the DeFi protocols, not from customers themselves. So you'll be able to come in, deposit some Bitcoin. If you have one Bitcoin, you need some money to go pay a student loan or, you know, pay for your daughter's wedding. You can just borrow money on your Bitcoin and pay interest off it. So it's actually live today, but like I said, we're constantly making the UI and UX easier and better. We brought on a phenomenal new tech team that's really, we're upping our game on all these things.
Yeah. Okay. So, what is the, are you targeting Indian customers only for this, or is this like a global product?
Yes, we're definitely a global. We're one of the few exchanges which does have a global, say, presence. We're probably 80-90% in India, right? And we're definitely targeting India. India is where we want to win and dominate, right? But in the longer run, you know, the blockchain and crypto is a global phenomenon. So what I envision happening is we become like, you know, a dominant brand within the South Asian framework for decentralized financial services, right? So it's easy for you. It's easy for anyone who is. So our mission, we talk about this, is that, you know, is financial freedom. We want to figure out how to, you know, we're fighting for financial freedom, and we think the best way is through blockchain, and specifically in India. So we want to win in India, but like I said, I do envision in the long run, the next couple decades, is we probably have a South Asian bent, but we are working globally in places like the United States and Canada and the UK. Right now, we're in Singapore, Australia, and India. Those are our core markets, but we envision expanding. That's where we're legally measured. You can actually buy crypto in pretty much every place other than in America, on crypto pairs. But we envision actually having crypto fiat, where you'll be able to buy Bitcoin for dollars or Canadian dollars pretty soon, in the next year or so.
Okay. So, how did you do the build-up again? Like, you know, you told me that the team went down to a pretty small number, and now you're back to about 200 people. So tell me about what all things you did once you took charge of Zepay.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that was the hard part. Like, see, you know, back when you know, during the crypto winter, convincing people that the spring and summer is coming is hard, right? Because it's totally dark. So we just step by step. So luckily, a lot of people believed in the company, believed in the team, believed maybe in me as a leader, and convince, like you say, four or five people to come join with us. They mostly stuck with the company, and really at that point it's just step by step. It was just like I said, stopping the bleeding, making sure we're not losing money. Once we had stabilized, then just brick by brick and like phenomenal person by person, going out and recruiting people and saying, hey, listen, this is what we're trying to build. We're trying to win. We want to build for the long run, and can you help us do it? And luckily the team it's amazing. It's getting better and better, literally. You know, each day, right? We have phenomenal people spread around the world. There's people in Australia, in Canada, in Europe, in America, in India, in Singapore. We have really great people spread all over, and just amazed at our team. In fact, the word we use within Zepay is this idea of Ohana, and Ohana is a Hawaiian word for family. And we, even though we're corporate in form, you know, we're trying to manage. We operate with an Ohana framework, and the idea there is we want win-win-win for all stakeholders. And I look at this as like there's three major stakeholders for let's say in you know in most let's say company type frameworks. There's the shareholders, there's the employees, and then there's the customers. And usually in most you know in most custom you know in most companies they're kind of hey listen your job is to create and keep a customer, but in the end you're trying to drive shareholder value, right? Our ethos is a little bit different. What we want to do is we want to kind of have win-win-win where we kind of treat them all equally. We all treat everyone like a family. So our framework is if you treat customers, employees, and shareholders like family, like with the kind of like this Ohana ethos, and you actually get incentives and you get economics in place. This is where you can get win-win-win type frameworks. And what I mean by that is, so you know, right now customers. They want what's best for them, which is understandable. They want the highest product, the highest quality product, highest service at the lowest price, right? Same thing with employees. Employees want great work environment. They want to get paid well. They want a really really great coworkers with happy people with kindness. And shareholders, same thing. Shareholders want to invest in companies which have great mission and stuff like that. And so. If we believe we can connect all three of these things, we can get honestly like a inflection point in growth. So now this is what Bitcoin has done. Like Bitcoin, it hasn't really raised any venture capital, right? It's been able to become a $1 trillion asset because they've done a great job of connecting kind of product market fit. And I actually remind a lot of the Zepay team is that. Don't look at Zepay as being a company. Look at us as being an extension of Bitcoin and Ether. Like our job, our ethos is that we're trying to blockchain the world through financial freedom. And what this means is if we make Bitcoin and Ether, if we make these amazing technologies widespread, we're able to spread them all over India. It's a win-win-win. And so that's what I envision happening. I envision happening over the next couple of years is that Bitcoin and Ether hodlers, or people who hold this stuff, or actually, they automatically get economic benefit in what Zepay does. And so, if you believe in Bitcoin and Ether, then you're going to believe in Zepay because Zepay is going to basically give you kind of extra returns back to you.
Okay. So right now, Bitcoin is pretty much like a rich man's plaything in India. Maybe it's not the case in the US, but here it's like people who have some money to burn. Are the kind of people who invest in Bitcoin because it's high risk and it is an unknown mystery right now.
It's considered high risk. One big thing which I want to really clear up is that a lot of people think that when you buy Bitcoin, you have to buy one single Bitcoin, right? Did you know that you can buy actually a fraction of a Bitcoin? I don't know if you knew that or not.
Yes. Yeah.
So many people think that it is. It's already run away, right? It's only for rich people. The fallacy in that, and that's what I'm saying, thought process is that, remember how like I told you when I bought a Bitcoin, it was about $100. It had already gone up 10 times, right? And the legal team or the compliance team would probably say, is it everyone's talking about, where's Bitcoin going? Is it undervalued or overvalued? I don't know if it's undervalued or overvalued, but I do know this. It's undervalued for the long run, meaning that Bitcoin price is going up. It has been in the past, and I'm pretty sure it will in the future. The reason why is the supply is limited and the demand is going up. And so I think Bitcoin is going to go from $40,000 to $400,000. When? I don't know. It might be 1 year. It might be 5 years. But the thing is, it has a much higher chance of increasing in value than the rupee does or the dollar does or even real estate. Right. So let's say, your current investments right now, you might be buying, some sort of equity stock, let's say Apple stock, or you might be buying some piece of real estate. It's hard for Apple to go up 10 times in value. Apple's already a pretty big asset. Right.
Right.
So if you look at the risk reward of what Bitcoin offers, right, it's still massive. Right. Meaning that Bitcoin as a brand is very likely going to be the most valuable brand in the world. Right. And people are like, what do you mean? Yeah. So I'm going to say just a pop quiz, right? So what do you think the most valuable brands in the world are right now? What are the biggest brands? Has it lots of brand value?
Google, Microsoft, Apple.
Yeah, right? So that's exactly it. Google, Microsoft, Apple, Facebook. Okay, now, What are the biggest brands? You know, if you go ask most people now have heard of Bitcoin. It's pretty amazing, right? Bitcoin, like, as a brand, is kind of like what Google was in 2005. People had heard of Google. They didn't really know what it was. Like, a lot of people, but like Facebook. In Facebook in 2008-09, they knew what social network was, but they weren't really using it. Bitcoin is the exact same way. People heard of Bitcoin. They think it's expensive, but man, their brand value is just going to grow. It, like, as the price goes up, as more people are using it. And same thing with Ether. You know, you've probably heard of Ethereum, right?
Yeah.
But then now, other than those two, to show you about brand value, what are the other coins or cryptocurrencies that you've heard of?
The ones that Elon Musk talks about.
Yeah. Dogecoin, right?
Yeah. Dogecoin, yeah.
Have you heard of any other ones?
No.
Right. And it's really interesting. The reason why you're exactly right is that people don't care about the 5th or 10th or 100th coin, right? And that's why Bitcoin can continue to accrue value, because people want high reward plus also safety. And that's what Bitcoin offers. Bitcoin offers really good growth, but because it is a blue chip company, it's a blue chip asset, it won't go down as much anymore.
Hmm.
In fact,
but in a way, couldn't you say it's a collective shared delusion? I mean, owning Apple is owning a revenue stream. Apple makes products, sells those products profitably, you know.
Yeah.
But what are you owning when you're owning Bitcoin, other than like a shared agreement?
You make a very, very, very good point, right? So Apple, when you own Apple, you own a share of Apple, and Apple is a company which sells products and services, right? But it is that, but it really is just a brand. Meaning, you're only buying an Apple product or service because you believe in it, right? Meaning that it's like Nike. You're only buying a Nike shoe because you believe in it, right? Now, what you're saying about Bitcoin is, see, Bitcoin is not it doesn't sell iPhones or shoes. But you got to realize Bitcoin's a brand. It stands for, like, financial freedom. So what you're buying when you buy a Bitcoin is this. See, when you own one Bitcoin right now, you can do two things with your Bitcoin. You can sit in your Bitcoin and just put it in cold storage, or you can actually lend it out right now, right? And so imagine you own one Bitcoin. It costs $40,000. Literally on Zepay right now, I think you can get 2%. You know, I have to go look. It's like 1 or 2%. So in some places you can get
2% per month or like
per year,
what?
Per year. Now you're saying, oh, that's awful. Okay. It's not great because I can get 10% on my rupees, right? The nuance is, you can get 10% on your rupee, but your rupee is going to depreciate against the Bitcoin, right? And so, what Bitcoin gives you, it actually can give you interest in. And if you want to keep that interest in rupees, keep it in rupees. If you want to keep it in Bitcoin, keep it in Bitcoin. With Apple right now, Apple will give you dividends, and same thing, Apple will give you like 1-2%. So I'm saying is the actual income you get from your Apple stock is actually less than the income you get from your Bitcoin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you actually can get money off of your Bitcoin if you choose to, right?
Who are the people who? How do you pay interest on Bitcoin? Who's borrowing it?
Yeah,
and why do they borrow it?
Yeah, sure. So there's a lot of people that borrow it. They borrow it because they want to basically short it. One, they want to hedge against it.
Okay,
right? The other thing is, people are providing as collateral. To do a loan, for example, like I said, like, you know, how you could borrow dollars using your Bitcoin, right? Just like some people want to borrow Bitcoin and then use it for, like, you know, buying more crypto or buying more Ether or selling against something. So there's a lot of different people. There's a lot of different use cases. There's tons of them.
Okay. And hasn't RBI again tightened the screws? I believe that. Banks are now not allowed.
No, I would say it, you know, we're still operating most banks are pretty open stuff. So it's really honestly a little bit of musical chairs. Some banks, you know, want to
first tell me, what is the mandate from RBI? What is it that they're?
It's fully
doing
legal.
Now?
Bitcoin's totally legal. You can buy it. Like, it's still, like, in a sense, in limbo. That there's no clear regulations on. It's considered a digital asset. They're not recommending it or not recommending it. You know, the core point is that it's not illegal. RBI is doing it.
And
yep.
How is RBI discouraging it? They're telling banks not to allow people.
I would say RBI is not discouraging it. It's just that they're not promoting it, right? And so, some banks still believe that the circular is valid. Luckily, they cleared this up a few months ago. Said, listen, the circular has been struck down by the Supreme Court. Bitcoin is legal. And
what did that circular say?
The original circular was that Bitcoin is in a sense highly speculative. We don't condone it, so we're going to cut off banking services to all Bitcoin and crypto businesses. But then the Supreme Court overturned that, said it's too restrictive. And since that time, we have some good banking relations. A lot of banks do accept it. Right? A lot of banks are taking it now. Right, but like I said it can change the whim, and so we've been around for 7 years for a long time, We are a blue chip, right? Say crypto financial services firm. So banks love working with us, and we're always opening doors. We're always talking to new banks, and they're great partners for us, and we're great partners for them.
So if I was want to invest on crypto through Zepay, then I would just be able to use my debit card and do the transaction.
Yep, exactly. You connect, you log in, you do your KYC, you connect your bank account, and you just buy Bitcoin. It's simple. You just log in and you just come in and you can buy some. And in fact, what we recommend is basically, dollar cost averaging, like buying small amounts of Bitcoin over the long run. In fact, that's what I do, right? I actually, every single day I buy a little bit of Ether, right? And if you do this strategy, see, the thing I remind people is that, people are like, oh, wow, Rahul, you knew about Bitcoin back when it was $10. Yeah, I did. And I did nothing about it for the first year, right?
Right.
Imagine if I'd put in like $1 per day back then. That's it, just $1 per day. And the same thing happens now. If you put in $1 per day and do it over the long run, you're going to get phenomenal, phenomenal returns. And that's what we recommend. And that's what Zeb, our new app, is doing, right?
And this can be automated. Yeah. Like I can just give a mandate and it will just debit whatever X rupees every day.
It'll debit 100 rupees. And we have 1,000 people that are doing this right now, and it's growing every single day. We recommend dollar cost averaging over the long run. And if you do this, I believe this promotes financial freedom in the world, right?
And how are you going to make it more ubiquitous in India, more accessible to people beyond just, say, tier one city folks, say maybe the top 1% of India currently would be either investing or considering investing in Bitcoin? How do you go to the next 10% or, the next 30%?
Like, Zepay right now has millions of users. And so, but yeah, we want 100 million users, right? It really is education, right? We're educating people that, hey, listen, if you want to save for your kids and grandkids and financial freedom, this is one of the best asset classes in the world. It absolutely positively is. And you should have some exposure. You should buy a little bits. And if we educate people by getting, really good influencers and, really educated, financial advisors, right? That's how we do it. And so I think what's going to happen over the next couple of decades, people will not just own gold, not just own stocks, not just own, real estate. Bitcoin is going to be at one of the center, central points of a really well diversified, financial, of a person's net worth.
So what is your customer acquisition strategy? Do you do paid ads or do you do social media or
it's all of the above and it's a mix of, let's say, paid media, SEO, advertising, the other thing is referral marketing, really upping the game on getting people to refer to, more of their friends and family to join. And it's good, but, we're adding. Go ahead.
What is the what's the strategy there? What is your referral plan like?
Yeah, so the main thing is people get 50% of the fees of their of anyone they refer for a certain amount of time.
Okay.
But like I said, the what we want to do ideally is not just pay dollar amounts, but also give us like I said, my goal is driving the cost down to zero. So like and we're still working with the team on this. We're trying to figure out ways of like maybe adding in like some sort of a token with economics, which benefits the more people you refer, the more benefits you get, right? And we haven't figured this out yet, but it would be something like that. Imagine that if you refer 10 people, then you get much better deals and much better rebates, right?
Got it. Okay. So what is the cost of transacting? Like, you know, you want to drive it down to zero.
Yeah.
What is it that it costs you? And, you know, there would be some cost for you also. Yeah. And what is it that it costs to the customer?
Yeah, exactly. So luckily we're an open order book, or an open order book exchange. So what this means is that we don't buy and sell ourselves. We just help individuals buy and sell with each other, right? And so we charge about roughly 10 basis points, 10 to 15 basis points. It depends upon the 10, you know, maybe 10 to 20 basis points on the maker versus taker. I mean, whether you're the one that hit the you know, bid or ask. What I mean by that is that whether you actually you can say, I want to sell Bitcoin for $40,000 while the price is $41,000, right? And what ended up happening here is someone has to come and buy it from you. So that's what like a taker fee or a maker fee is. So we charge fees there. And the other thing we do charge membership fees. The goal of this long term is we're trying to build a premium product where we have phenomenal benefits for our members, right? And there's also like network fees. Whenever you send Bitcoin on a network, you do pay a fee to the network. So we put a limit on there because we have wallet costs and infrastructure costs. But like I said, my long-term goal is to be one of the highest quality exchanges at the lowest possible cost. So we actually compare ourselves to like what the large exchanges do, and we're constantly trying to drive costs down every single day.
What is the network fee? Like, how many basis points?
Yeah, so that kind of depends upon like each network is different. But so let's say like, you know,
okay,
sending like, you know, one Bitcoin on the Bitcoin network might cost like say 0.0004, and then we'll charge 0.0006. Like we'll charge a bit more than that because we have to do all the accounting and mechanism and actually do the send fees, things like that. Right. That fee actually goes to the Bitcoin miners. We don't keep most of that. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so what if you were to become like a zero brokerage?
Like a zero DAO.
Like zero DAO.
The idea is in the longer run we can eventually drive. I really do think we can drive the cost down to zero, right? And so my anticipation is that it might take you know, 1 or 2 or 3 years, but once you're at scale, because you know this really is just a marketplace. If you survive and you can get enough people coming on board, the cost can be almost nothing, right? And that's what we want to do, because that's how India's not a super wealthy country, right? We need to lower the cost as much as possible to make it widespread.
So what stops you from doing that today and just finding investors to fund it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. See, we could go, that's the whole thing. See, any investor who comes in is going to say, you can do this, but then, you know, they want an investment return, right? And so, but like I said, if we're driving costs down to zero, right?
More sustainable way to do it.
Well, here's the thing, is how do we return the money back to investors, right? The thing is we're trying to balance both growth, high quality, high service, and also getting a ton of customers, right? And so it is a delicate balance, and we're thinking about that. We're actually trying to figure out whether do we want to raise capital, do we want to go it our own, and we haven't decided yet for sure.
If you were to raise capital, what kind of valuation would you be seeking?
I mean, you see a lot of this stuff now that you know, it says, I think CoinSwitch raised about $25 million at a $5 million valuation. Sounds like CoinDCX did too. Supposedly CoinDCX is raising capital at near $1 billion valuation. You know, I would say, I think Zepay is worth around, you know, $500 million to $1 billion, right? You know, so we're profitable, we're making money, we're growing, we don't need the capital, and so. We're open, you know, we constantly talk with people, but I said, like, because we don't need the capital, we haven't been actively thinking about it. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So, like, you know, what do you think ZepPay will be like, say, 10 years from now?
Yeah. So that's the big thing is that I envision us moving more into becoming DAO-like. And what I mean, a DAO stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization. And most people are like, what the heck does that even mean? What is, these are, I look at them is, imagine like the way, you know, Bitcoin is digital gold. A DAO is like a digital company. And what does that mean? See, right now, a company has shares, has shareholders, customers, employees, their legal structures. In the longer run, like, there's a really cool decentralized app called Uniswap. Uniswap is basically a DAO. And what I envision is, over the long run, ZPay becomes more like a DAO and less. Yeah.
How would making ZPay a DAO benefit Rahul?
Yeah.
Like, you know, would you have like a lot of coins of that DAO then, and therefore that's how it would benefit you? Or?
Oh yeah, so me,
because
so,
then you are no longer a CEO then, right? I mean, there is no such thing as a CEO for a DAO or like a founder.
Yep, exactly. In many ways, becoming a DAO, you have to be a little bit selfless. Like, so I would say Bitcoin is a little bit like this. Bitcoin's a DAO. See, Satoshi Nakamoto, if he kept all the coins of Bitcoin, he'd be even more rich than he is now. But he isn't that rich because he kind of gave it away, and so. Like, if we become a DAO, in a sense, I'm giving up a lot of stuff, right? I'd be giving up a lot of equity and economic value. But the benefit here is by giving the value back to the customer, back to the consumers, right? The members win, right? And the members can decide. There's no CEO, but there's a group of people who are running it. And if maybe a group of like 7 people or a group of 12 people, you don't need tons. And then it's more open source. If any innovation happens, it's happening, you know, on you know, through an open source framework, right? And if you go look at something, a really cool idea is like if you look at this, like these are things that are kind of like, let's say, if you go look at a browser, like a browser is open source, right? If you go look at like innovation happening, a lot of there's a lot of open, like Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia is like an open source encyclopedia, right? See, you could eventually imagine you made Wikipedia into a DAO. And then, you know what, you have a premium version of Wikipedia, which costs a bit extra, but like, you know, has, I don't know, some higher quality content. See, you could design Wikipedia into a DAO, right? And I'm not saying it's a good idea or not, but the point there is that in the future, new business models and new organizations will organize around token economics and DAOs, then being venture capital backed and corporations.
Okay. That's like a pretty interesting vision of the future. So, I mean, you envision that, you know, like for the last 20 or so years, I believe that, I mean, most studies say that inequality is rising. You know, the top 1% is getting richer and the bottom 50% is getting poorer. But so something like what you are visioning as a decentralized kind of a future, would that like reverse this trend? Or?
Yeah, that's I would say a big part of, say, my personal belief, right? So I think I always use this quote. I always say this a lot. Is that, see, you know, in my own personal mission, you know, my goal isn't to make, you know, rich people more rich. What you're talking about, you know, if you're looking at Bitcoin, you're worried about that. The richer is getting richer. It's, I want to make poor people not poor, right? And that doesn't mean poor people become rich. It just means, Is it if you can help people out of poverty, the world will be a vastly better place than helping rich people, like, you know, just have a ton more capital. And I think systems like this help solve that, right? Is if you can imagine Facebook is owned by the Facebook users. Imagine Twitter is owned by the Twitter users. Imagine, you told me, Google's massive, right? In fact, one of our portfolio companies, Brave Browser, really, really cool company. It's got 35 million monthly active users, 13 million daily active users, amazing company, right? They are growing really, really fast, really because they're giving a lot of economics back to their users. You should actually go to brave.com, download the browser. You'll see some really, really cool stuff. If the more you use Brave, the more they have a really cool token called BAT, the basic attention token. The more tokens you make, you basically make money. But you're going, how do I do that? It's because,
right? Yeah. So you can actually monetize your attention.
Yep.
Wow, that's amazing.
And listen, I've made $300-$500 just for free browsing on Brave.
Hmm.
Right?
Hmm.
And you can too.
Yeah.
Just go to Brave, download it. And if you want to, you can keep it in BAT tokens, or if you want, you can convert it to rupees. Come to ZetPay, convert that BAT to rupees if you want. Right.
Well, okay. That's amazing.
And there's you know, 4 million people in India who are doing this right now.
Right? So say somebody who's like a, you know, earning a couple of lakhs a year, which means let's say he takes home 20,000-30,000 a month, and he's saving, let's say, 3,000 a month. Would you recommend to someone like that to also take advantage of crypto?
Absolutely positively. Like, you know, like I believe in this, like, with my heart and soul. And what I mean by that is that this is one of the best, you know, this is the best place for cap. You should always keep a little bit of cash for emergencies. But other than that, like, I think Bitcoin, Ether, BAT, these tokens are some of, are going to be some of the best performing assets in the world over the next several decades, right? It'll be almost impossible for any other, you know, asset to do as well as this, just because it comes down to supply and demand. It comes down to trends. It comes down to technology. Based upon a mix of all of the above, you know, Bitcoin, Ether, BAT, these tokens are some of the most important innovations of our lifetime.
This would be as liquid as investing in, say, a mutual fund.
Oh, it's better. It's more liquid. More liquid. It's 24 hours, 7 days a week liquidity, right? And if they ever go abroad, they don't have to wait. If they're in, you know, in Singapore, they're in, you know, Sri Lanka, right? They can convert it into whatever they want and then convert it back into that local currency. They can use it directly. I envision 10 years from now, you'll be able to use your Bitcoin to pay for a hotel in Sri Lanka.
So, you know, these investment companies like Zerodha and Grow,
yeah,
if they start offering the same kind of product of, you know, like investing in Bitcoin, and so wouldn't that be like a pretty adverse event for companies Zepay? Like Zepay?
Yeah, I think yes and no. Like yes, in the sense it's a new competitor, but no, in the sense that I think the more the merrier, to be honest. Like, as Bitcoin becomes more widespread, the price goes up, and you want a ton of people taking this stuff, like we do, right? ZetPay itself is a large Bitcoin holder. Like, you know, we own Bitcoin on our balance sheet. We love it. We think other companies should own Bitcoin on their balance sheet, right? And so, you know, Zerodha should move in. You know, PayPal is already in the space. Like, you know, Grow be moving in. There's another company that we're actually talking about partnering with, a company called Vested Financial. Have you heard of them? Vested, a really cool company. They help people in India buy U.S. stocks, right?
Okay. Right. Yeah.
So, if you want to buy Apple or Tesla, you can go through them. I think slowly over time, like a lot of, let's say, fintech companies will allow Bitcoin, and that's, I think that's a good, that's a win for everyone.
Hmm. And are you also planning to offer NFTs on ZetPay?
Yeah, so we were actually one of the very first people studying this stuff. We haven't announced it yet, but I'll go and give you a preview now. We're working with a really cool company called Yat, and Yat, it's actually phenomenal. They've designed, if you go to y.at Yat, or if you Google Yat emoji, what Yats have done is they've made these really cool emoji usernames, and to me, What an NFT, really cool idea for people who don't know, it's a non-fungible token. The idea behind this is that you can basically give a token value to almost anything, both a physical world asset, but also a scarce digital asset, right? And people probably heard, oh, someone's making, you know, an image and it's selling for millions of dollars. Images are just one thing. You can do this with, let's say, an MP3, with a video file, with even a piece of software, right?
Or like Jack Dorsey's first tweet or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What Yats have done is they basically made an NFT out of emojis. So you can basically own an emoji. For example, if you go to my Twitter profile, you'll see that I own Apple, Apple, Apple. So three apples in a row.
Okay.
And
okay.
You'll be able to type in Apple, 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 for example, into the Brave browser. And what it'll do, it'll go to my page. So it's like a mix of a domain name, a crypto address, or an email address, right? And all these things will resolve in the back end. And what's amazing is they've sold tens of thousands of these things, tons of them, right? To tens of thousands of different people, right? And We're going to partner with them. We're actually launching a Zebra token. We're really excited about this. This would be a Zebra emoji, right? And the idea behind the Zebra token is the more zebras you have, the more value you're going to get, right? I'd love for you to test it out, man. So the idea here is that, like, if we can build like an NFT with some unique, let's say, utility value to it, there's a lot of cool things, right? So example, you have zebra, heart, zebra, heart, zebra, like a five-letter emoji username with your alternating zebras and hearts. This would be like your ID now. Like I could send you Bitcoin to zebra, heart, right? And it can be Bitcoin, Ether, whatever. But what's also cool is you could actually make that your username, and it's censorship resistant. So in the long run, I think people will eventually make, this will be like a really cool way for online identity. And Zepe is actually one of the launch customers for this thing called Yat. We plan on integrating it into our NFT platform and allowing users. We want to allow our users to buy high quality NFTs like this.
So, can you have fractional ownership of NFTs also? Like, say, a digital art which got sold through NFT. Can there be fractional ownership of that?
Yeah,
that is also like same as Bitcoin only, right?
Yeah,
it's like a blockchain contract. Okay.
For example, there's a really famous one called CryptoPunks. They're actually probably some of the most famous NFTs that are out there. You can kind of sense wrap them up and you can fractionalize them. So a normal CryptoPunk costs now, I don't know, call it $40,000 or $50,000, right? Just like a Bitcoin. See, you can technically only own one full CryptoPunk, but the cool thing about fractionalization is you can own like a piece of it. And that's what's happening. People are buying pieces of art in a sense.
And so do you plan to make this available also on Zepe?
Yeah. Like, so we're working with a really cool team right now. We're incubating a team to figure out how we can, help artists, creators, and all of the above move into the space.
If there's one takeaway from this conversation, then it's this. Don't wait to invest in cryptocurrency. Head on to zepe.com and start investing now.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.
This episode of Founder Thesis podcast is brought to you by Long Haul Ventures. Long Haul Ventures is the long haul partner for founders and startups that are building for the long haul. More about them is at www.longhaulventures.com.